This is 3 February and I'm continuing the interview with Carol Summerhouse. Carol, at the last meeting you mentioned a name which I hadn't come across before, Mary Newport. You referred to her as some kind of a role model. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Perhaps not so much as a role model, as I think I said that she was what I aspired to be, in that she was the secretary to the Prime Minister's press secretary, and I was hoping that with a change of government, that's the job I might end up with. In the event, I didn't. I ended up with the job as personal secretary to the PM. But in the earlier days, I guess I was thinking if I could be Mary Newport, I'd be very happy.
So what can you tell me a bit more about Mary herself?
She's still around Canberra. She worked for the Liberal government for a long time. I don't really know her very well. She does good works even after she's finished work. I think she does a lot of work for the Catholic Church in Canberra, but I really haven't been kept in touch with her. I wasn't a friend, but as I say, she was on the other side of the political divide in those days.
Going back a little bit as well, Jenny Hocking, in her recent biography of Whitlam, refers to Whitlam's office as, quote, small, highly productive, slightly chaotic office structure, end quote.
Small, highly productive. Well, certainly small. There were only, I think, 7 of us, and it was small. We were crowded. We had, I think, as was the way of things in those days, the men, the advisors, had offices of their own. Barbara Stewart and I shared a sort of open space outside the refrigerator where we just had a desk each. That was the extent of our sort of personal space. So it was small, chaotic, slightly chaotic. I guess she might have perceived that because we all had to do a bit of everything. It depended who was around when the leader asked for something. Whoever was within earshot probably got the job. There was no real marked delineation of roles, except generally, I suppose. There was somebody who answered the phone and ushered the visitors in. But if she was out of the office, one of the others of us would do that. It just was a very flexible working arrangement, I think not just between we girls, but I think also between the men, because Graham Frydenberg wasn't a morning person. So when there were press questions to be answered for the afternoon press, which had to be answered in the morning, somebody else would have to handle that. So I think that's about the only reason you could call it slightly chaotic, just that everybody did a bit of everything.
The office, how you describe it, functioned much along what then would be a typical gender divide.
I think that's right. I think in those days, it was 1975, wasn't it, when Whitlam first appointed Elizabeth Reid as an advisor on women's issues. But up until, and that was a growing awareness, I suppose, of the need to address women's issues. Elizabeth, in fact, I went to school with Elizabeth here in Canberra, but she had, in fact, in her office in when we moved around here to the refurbished Prime Minister's office in early 73, she had a poster up on her wall of Golda Meir, who was then Prime Minister of Israel, saying, with a caption underneath saying, "Yes, but can she type?" And so there was an element of... we did this sort of the junior, the less important work. The men did the thinking, advising, strategic sort of a work. We weren't really asked for our opinions very often.
Well, that makes an interesting question. Did you ever get involved in policy issues at all?
Oh, very, very, very rarely. I do remember we had a bit of an outburst on the issue of abortion, where I think a few of we girls in the office thought that the men weren't taking enough notice of what women felt on the question. I know it was very sensitive in that pre-72 period because of the importance of the Catholic Church to the Labour victory, or Catholic votes, I suppose. And so it had to be handled very diplomatically. But we were, as women, a bit angry that women's viewpoints you didn't seem to be as important as, or didn't seem to be listened to as much as we thought perhaps they should. Nothing more than that. I think I can't remember any other policy issue that I would have had expressed a view on.
In that particular issue, how did you express those views?
Oh, I think we just said, look, you blokes ought to be listening to women for a change, or some fairly short, brief outburst. It didn't last long.
Well, there was also in Jenny Hawking's book, she refers to you and Barbara snapping at Whitlam and what's called the office, quote, long hairs, end quote. Now, who were the office long hairs?
Well, I think that's a reference back to Arthur Calwell's description of Whitlam's staff. Arthur was very bitter about Whitlam getting the leadership, and he described Whitlam's staff as a bunch of long hairs. But in the context of Barbara and I snapping at Whitlam and the long hairs, that would have been the occasion, the expressing our view about the need to listen to women's views on abortion.
But otherwise, you kept the peace in the office.
We did. Well, we did. Yes, we knew our place.
There was, during your time there, there was an interesting relationship in terms of the time and era. Ainsley Gotto and Ray Matthews are referred to. There's quite a bit of information about their relationship in Jenny Hawking's book.
And would you believe, I did not know that was happening. I knew that Race and Ainsley were perhaps friendly. I was pretty naive and innocent. I didn't really think about it anymore. I certainly didn't know that they were living together or were as serious as apparently they were. Race had lost his first wife, I think I don't remember exactly when, probably 67, 68. And he came in 67, so it might have been 68. So he was a widower at that time. But no, it just goes to show how discreet they were, and how, I suppose, we didn't think to gossip about people.
Were there any other cases like that, relationships across the corridors?
Oh, many, many. Yes, there were lots of friendships, relationships across political parties, between people in opposing political parties. I mean, I had my best friend at the time. I'd been overseas for a couple of years with. She was working in, I think I might have mentioned it in the last interview, she was working in the in the Liberal government, and I was working in the Labour side, but we were still good friends. I know of several other people who had really good friendships, and they worked in opposing parties' offices. It was about trust between the friends, I suppose. If you did spill some beans that you shouldn't have spilled, you knew that your friendship with your friend would mean that it didn't go any further. That's, I think, the bottom line.
So that's an interesting situation. Do you think that could happen today?
I don't know. I don't know enough people who work around here now, or in Parliament House now. I think 1975 and the dismissal of the Whitlam government drove a bit of a shaft between the political parties. It did tend to intensify feelings in both directions, and I think that some of those intensified feelings would mean that certainly in the period since 75, the same friendly relationships didn't exist between staff from different political parties. But it wasn't just staff, it was members of Parliament too were friends. I mean, Jim Killen used to spend an awful lot of time hanging around in the evenings in our office. There were several others who would drop by. Friendships did span political parties, but they possibly still do. I'm not in a position to know now.
And you began in Whitlam's office, in the leader of the opposition's office in 1967. You've, apparently then, there is reference to you participating or being involved in the work leading up to the Corio by-election in July of that year.
That's right. That was an interesting time. It was bitterly cold. You can imagine Geelong in July. And as used to happen during by-elections, one of us, usually either Barbara or myself, would go to the place where the by-election was focused on, in this case Geelong, and there was another one in Capricornia, which involved Barbara going up to Rockhampton. And she was there for 2 or 3 weeks, as I was in Geelong mostly for 2 or 3 weeks. And one of us would be based there, I suppose, doing the liaison work between the local party people and the leader's office. And Labour Party had rented or been given the premises of a toy shop in Geelong, and half of the toy shop, I sat for 2 or 3 weeks in my very pretty pink overcoat. I wouldn't wear it, be seen dead in it now, but it was the thing at the time, typing envelopes. So here I am in Geelong, this exciting career I have, typing envelopes on a portable typewriter, not electric, in this toy shop, waiting for people to come in the door and ask questions, I suppose. I don't remember dealing with the public. I think it probably wasn't the campaign office. It was just a space for a staffer like me. Barbara did the same thing. She went to Rockhampton for 2 or 3 weeks when that by-election was at its height.
Just the books say that Graham Friedenberg's book refers to that Whitlam and his staff, which I presume included you, actually lived in the Travelodge Motel.
We lived in Travelodge motels everywhere. We'd go from place to place to place. We always went to the Travelodge. You'd wake up in a Travelodge furnished room and you wouldn't have a clue where you were, because they all looked the same. They all had the same furniture, the same carpet, the same basic layout. So it was, you had to sometimes work out where you were before you set out the door.
Any memories of the time there together? I mean, you must have been living pretty close together.
Well, we did it a lot. I mean, we did it for conferences, we were often travelling. It would normally be only, I suppose, Mr. and Mrs. Whitlam, and maybe one of the children occasionally, and usually only one or two of the staff. Maybe for a by-election, there'd be more people there but not a party any greater, I'd say, than about 4 or 5. Well, that was somebody had to stay in Canberra and mind the shop, so that was probably the maximum number that were down there then. But no, I don't have any particular memory of the Travelodge in Geelong, because as I say, they just all blur into each other, the Travelodges.
Was that the year when Gough Whitlam spoke at a series of state ALP conferences, and you, among other places, an event in Adelaide?
Yes, that was before the Corio by-election. It was over the June long weekend, when it may still be, a tradition that the state Labor parties had their conferences over the Queen's Birthday long weekend in June. So we had been in Victoria for the Victorian ALP conference on the Friday night, when Whitlam famously got stuck into the Victorian executive and ripped strips off them, and was basically saying they had to play the game differently or there was no chance of Labor getting into government federally. And so that created a huge ruckus. And I think it's even in Graham Frydenberg's book, he said that on that occasion, Arthur Corwell, as I said, the bitter old man that he was, said, "I don't think you'll be working for your new boss for much longer." So obviously the Victorians were feeling really cocky. But anyway, Gough gave his speech on the Friday night. We then went to Adelaide and we had a speech prepared for the South Australian State Conference. But when we got to the airport, Don Dunstan, who was leader of the party, but not leader of government, I think he was only leader of the opposition, I wouldn't swear to that, met us at the airport, and having read the papers about the reaction to the Victorian speech, asked Whitlam not to continue in that vein in South Australia, not to upset his apple cart. So the speech had to be changed, and I think that's probably the incident that you're referring to, where we had to take the back... We had all the press copies of the speech printed up, so we had to take the I think fortunately it was just the back section of the speech, or it was possible to separate the offending part of the speech away from the rest of it. And so we did a bit of shuffling paper on the tarmac and in the back of the car, trying to staple things together with these offending bits taken out.
Did it all work out in the end?
I think it all went very smoothly after that, and nobody really would have known that any of that had happened, except Graham's written about it, which is good, reasonable, fact, how things happen, flexibility.
Your flexibility, no doubt.
Oh, everybody's, yeah.
So you travelled with him throughout, visiting, doing all the state conferences?
Well, yes, one of us normally would go. We didn't. We were away an awful lot. He always had either Barbara or I as a stenographer there, because there were always things needing to be worked on by us.
In early 1968, Gough Whitlam resigned as leader of the Labour Party.
He did.
Can you remember that?
I remember. I do remember a feeling of real trepidation. It was a very brave move and a very risky move. I just remember that feeling of trepidation. I think there was mixed opinions within the office about whether it was a good idea or not, but Gough was a bit inclined to do his own thing his own way at his own pace. The other thing I remember particularly about that was a letter, the Jim Cairns letter. I think Whitlam decided to resign because he wanted to, it was to do with the Victorian ALP's influence, and it wasn't initially there wasn't a leadership challenge, but Jim Cairns decided to run against him, and then Jim Cairns wrote a letter, I suppose, to all the caucus members, and the part of it that I remember was the sentence, whose party is this, his or ours? And I thought that was a very telling phrase. I learned later that actually Philip Adams wrote that line. But whoever the author, it was just an interesting thing to think about. I suppose even with my loyalty to Whitlam, it just gave me pause for thought. In the end, he squeaked back, but I think he felt it had been worthwhile.
Were you aware that he was going about to resign?
No, I don't think anybody was. Oh, I don't know. He may have sought the advice of some of the men, but no, I don't know who typed the letter. I can't remember that now. But it probably was done by announcement first, and paperwork followed.
So the first you heard about it was when it was
when it had happened.
News.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, in the office, I do remember the sort of space. It's funny, where I was, just near my little desk. But no, it would have been, he might have announced to us that he was going to resign. He probably would have announced to the staff, now I think about it, that he was going to resign the leadership, and for whatever reason, because our jobs were on the line as well. I mean, if he'd lost his job, we would have lost ours.
And your personal feelings about the time, were you concerned, worried?
Well, as I said, I was a little nervous. I suppose I wasn't thinking too much about myself, because there would always be other jobs to be had. But no, I was worried for him. I was worried for, I suppose, a little bit for the team, that if he weren't to succeed, that everything would fold up.
Then comes soon, not that long after, the beginnings of the 1969 campaign. Can you tell me what was your involvement in the campaign from the beginning through?
It would have been the preparation of the policy speech, and that would have been, I would have been taking notes from Graham over a period of Graham Frydenberg, over a period of, I suppose, weeks before the 69 campaign. And then normally election campaigns about 3 weeks, so we would have started travelling 3 weeks before on a RAF aircraft. Always the leader of the opposition was allocated a RAF aircraft in that In those days, we were on Hawker Siddeley's HS-748s, which were propeller-driven aircraft. They didn't have, they might have had one, I don't think they had the back 111s. I don't know what type of aircraft they had, but we had the HS-748. So we rocketed around the countryside in this thing from here to there and hopping off somewhere different every day and every evening doing up a release, or every afternoon doing up a release for the press, which was designed to catch the evening television news. So I suppose we did it about 4 o'clock. I think I'm right in saying that still in 1969 we were using carbon paper. So if we had more than 6 or 7 journalists travelling with us, you'd have to do 2 strikes of everything, 2 strikes of any press release, because the carbon paper would only produce about 6 clear copies. So, and then, yeah, campaigns were, a lot of public meetings in those days. Didn't have any responsibility for taking notes of speeches. I think they were mostly, notes were prepared, and he spoke from, if he used notes, that would have been probably our record of the speech. It didn't seem as important in those days to keep track of every word that was uttered.
Mm. What was your role, Jeff?
Well, I was still principally Graham Frydenberg's steno, but I was also, doing a bit of everything. We had to, whatever was on, I can't be more specific than that, really, because these election campaigns, every day is different from every other day, except for the, as I say, the 4 o'clock sort of press release. But we were travelling, we were sorting out rooms, looking after the press. They used to travel on the same plane. So because I was working for the press secretary, I'd have some responsibilities for trying to make sure that the press guys were happy, knew what was going on.
Well, you were, was Graham Frydenberg the press secretary?
He
as
was
well.
Still the press secretary in 69, yeah. But we all used to muck in and do a bit of everything. But there were certain things that had to be done, like making sure the daily program, because people were in those days a little coy about advertising where they were going to be too far ahead, so that you didn't want your meetings stacked by opponents. Or this terrible man called the Skull we used to see at election meetings in Sydney. So sometimes it was only a day or so before that the program for the following day would be put out to the press. I mean, they, as I say, were travelling with us, so they had some idea, but not the specific details always. So that sort of thing. Life went on. There were people ringing up with suggestions and speeches and letters and telegrams.
Did you attend the public meetings?
Sometimes, not always. But sometimes, yep.
It sounded that if there were times the concern about having intrude and interrupt.
Well, it was a thing that happened in those days. There used to be hecklers. The opposition political forces would, if they knew there was a meeting on, just turn up and try and make it a little more difficult for the speaker. Both sides, all sides did it, some more effectively than others.
Any particular ones that you can remember?
Not that I can remember, no. We had a bit of a police accompaniment in, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. I remember there were always plainclothes police lurking around in the wings, because they could recognise political agitators like this guy called the Skull, who was a Nazi sympathiser and used a very big, tall man, and used to make a lot of noise. But you'd suddenly see that somebody would spot the Skull, and then you'd see there'd be 1 or 2 police that you recognised on either side of him. So that sort of that's the way that sort of thing seemed generally to be handled, by if the person was identifiable. But sometimes they just were hecklers. But
did you Gough Whitlam, or anybody in the group, have any protection?
No. Not, as I say, apart from the special branch in New South Wales, stuck pretty close. Queensland, special branch, Joe Bjelke-Petersen's boys, used to try and stick pretty close, but we used to try and avoid them. I mean, they were there for the right, for the presumably for the right reason, but we didn't trust them so much. But there was no federal police protection. I think it was not until the 72 campaign that an officer from Prime Minister's Department travelled with us, Rod Strawn. He seemed to be, he was a civilian, but whether he was the security advisor, and that was not at the officer's request. I think it was something that the government thought should happen. I mean, Arthur Caldwell, there'd been that attempted assassination of Arthur Caldwell, and I suppose they thought that Whitlam was perhaps a bit of a target for some people. But that was state police forces, special branch, were probably around in other places, and I didn't know who they were, so I wouldn't have recognised them.
And you didn't feel threatened at any point during your travels, in any sense of there was a risk in
that? No. Maybe too naive. Well, times were different too.